lecture that I'm going to be giving today is a bit different from the previous lectures. And previous lectures, we've been mainly concerned with economic theory. After all, this course on economic reasoning. But the lecture I'm giving today is still concerned with economic reasoning, otherwise we're not giving the right lecture for the course. But we're more concerned than in the previous lectures with philosophical issues. So I should say what I'm going to be talking about today, if you can get some idea of some of the issues that will be covered in the course I'm going to be giving with Danny Sanchez starting next week on libertarian ethics. If you are thinking about taking that class, and I hope you are, because as I said last week, the more money for me, the more people take that course, you'll be able to get some idea of at least what you'll be getting in that course, what kind of style that I'll be giving based on what I'm saying today. And what we'll be doing in this lecture, also remember last time I mentioned Jay had asked a question on what was the relation between the economic reasoning I was giving and certain policy descriptions there, say, well, tariffs are a bad idea. So what was the relation between that kind of statement, seems like a policy or an ethical statement, and economic reason, the economic analysis. So in the lecture today, we're going to be really addressing that question, or the issues that arise in considering that question. Now, the basic starting point we have to bear in mind is that economics, like other sciences, is a descriptive science. It's saying how a particular realm operates in according to the way Austrian economics thinks of economics is developing what is involved in the notion of human action. Other economists take economics in a different way. But in any case, what you're doing in economics, regardless of whether you're an Austrian economist or a neoclassical economist, is describing a certain aspect of reality. So in this way, economics is like the physical sciences. You know, if you read Austrian economics, what's usually stressed is the differences between the method of economics and the method in physical sciences. Method of economics in Austrian economics is deductive. We start from the axiom of action that people act, and we try to deduce what follows from the concept of action. But physical sciences are more empirical, or trying to investigate the world. So a basic difference in method. But what I want to stress now is not this difference in method, but there's one respect, at any rate, in which economics is like the physical sciences. They're all properly called sciences. What is the respect that they're similar? That economics, like physics or chemistry or biology, astronomy, is trying to discover regularities in the world. They're trying to discover laws of nature. All the scientists are trying to discover laws of nature. Say, we're considering a certain aspect of the world. We say, what is the nature of that world? Say, in physics, we're saying, well, what is the nature of matter, energy? What are laws we can find out about how matter and energy behaves? So we're trying to discover a certain what's going on in a certain area of reality. Now, when we're doing that, whether results are good or bad is not part of science. For example, I suppose we learn from astronomy, I don't know if this is the currently accepted view, but I think it is, that the universe originated from a big bang that took place several billion years ago. Now, when that theory first came did, and there were some astronomers who didn't like that theory because they said, well, this is saying that there's some kind of asymmetry in nature. This particular time when the universe began is different from other times. They didn't like that. But even if they didn't, as long as that's the way the world turned out to be, that's the way the world turned out to be, that's the best established theory. So that's all that counts. In the physical sciences, we're not concerned with whether results are good or bad. Maybe you don't, let's say we say, well, the universe is eventually going to die out. Maybe that's not a good idea, that's not very good, but this is the way things are. Somebody says Big Bang was originally a derogatory name for that theory. Yes, I think that's right. It was Fred Hoyle who was a big opponent in favor of the competing steady state theory, called it that. You're quite right. So, in like another example, just get from history of science, in the ancient world, a circle was considered the most perfect geometric form, so it was thought that the planets traveled in circles just because this is the most perfect way of doing things. And when it turned out planets don't travel in circles, so we can't say, well, just because from a certain point of view, whether that's right or wrong, it would be a good thing if planets traveled in circles. That doesn't affect whether they do or not. And the same point, namely in having a descriptive science, we're trying to say or figure out how the world operates, how certain aspects of the world operates. It's true in economics as well. For example, remember in one of the previous lectures I said, I was mentioning money has diminishing marginal utility. Remember what that means? That whenever we have a good, have a good that consists of certain units, that we're assessing these units for the purpose of action. So we'll put the first unit that we get to our most highly valued use, then the next unit to our next most highly valued use, and so on. So the uses diminish in value. That's called diminishing marginal utility. This means we're putting the units of the good to less and less valued uses. And this applies to money too. So when we say this, this is just a state judgment about how the nature of money, saying this is truth about money. And this doesn't imply that it's a good or bad that money has this feature. It just does have this feature. That's a fact about it. Now, I say this is a basic feature of science. It's just trying to describe a world, a certain feature of the world. Now, some economists want to make sure that economics is descriptive science because they think all value judgments are subjective. What do I mean by that when I say value judgments are subjective? Well, suppose I say something like, intervention in foreign wars is a bad thing. It's bad that one country intervenes in the affairs of another country. So that's a value judgment. I'm saying something is good or bad. I'm saying intervention in foreign country is a bad thing. It's bad. So suppose somebody said, well, a value judgment like that is subjective. Now what would we mean by that? Well, that is dependent on the personal opinion. If you think that value judgments are subjective, you mean, well, just people have different opinions about them, there isn't any truth of the matter. Just like suppose you say, I like vanilla ice cream, somebody else says, no, I don't like vanilla, I like chocolate, I don't like ice cream at all. Of course, there'd be something wrong with you if you said that. But we wouldn't say on people favoring particular flavors of ice cream, not liking ice cream at all, that one was right or wrong. So if somebody had this view about value judgment, they were subjective, that person would be saying, well, value judgments are just like preferences for ice cream. There's no right or wrong in that. Now, I see comment from Michael that Rand would argue that all ethics must end with human survival. Yes, that's an extremely, but she does hold that, and just for that reason, she's not a subjectivist in this, that she thinks ethics isn't dependent on personal opinion. She thinks that the purpose of each person's life is his own survival as a human being, and that's true even if you don't have that opinion. She thinks that's the case. So she's not a subjectivist in the way I'm using the term here. But you see, there are some economists who think all value judgments are subjective. They think they're just personal opinions. Actually, Mises was one of those. He thought, if you say, well, is a value judgment true or false? Is it something more than just an opinion? He would say, no, that isn't. That's wrong. Value judgments are just personal opinion. So if you hold that view, if you think that value judgments are just subjective opinions, that then you can see why you wouldn't want to say that why you want economics to be a descriptive science, because if you have a descriptive science, you're claiming that something, the propositions of science are true. They're not just matters of opinion. If we say the universe began with a big bang several billion years ago, that is something that the astronomers who contend that think is true. It isn't just they like that view or they want it to be true. They say it is true. So if you say science is trying to find out how the world really is, and you also hold that value judgments are subjective, it just matters of opinion, then you can see why you don't want to have value judgments in descriptive science. So if you hold this view, this is one that Mises held also, Lionel Robbins, who was a famous economist in the 30s, had an influential book called Nature and Significance of Economic Science, is an important statement of economic method that was very influential. Now, he held this view of value judgments too. So see, what those people want to say is, look, in economics, we want it to be an objective science, so we can't have value judgments in the science, because then those are just expressions of opinion, so we don't want them. That would ruin our claim to be an objective science. But what I want to make clear is economics is not committed to this view about this opinion about ethics. Suppose you think that ethics is objective, and by that I mean ethical judgments are true or false, just in the same way we say it's true that I'm giving a lecture now. Maybe you wish it were false, but it's true I'm giving a lecture. So if you say ethical judgments are true or objective, you say they're straightforwardly true or false, and not just matters of opinion. So suppose you hold that view, this is contrasting the view that ethical judgments are just subjective, you can still hold that economics is a descriptive science. You just wouldn't have that particular reason for saying that it should be a descriptive science, namely you don't want to have subjective preferences in a descriptive science. But you could still say it's a descriptive science even if you think ethical judgments are objective, and you say, well, that's just the way that science works. We have science is trying to figure out how a particular aspect of reality works, and it doesn't incorporate judgment about what should be the case, or what's good or bad is just a description. So you see, you could still hold economics as a descriptive science, even if you think ethical judgments are objective. Now, I want to discuss now a related issue. Now, there's a famous passage in great philosopher David Hume's treatise of human nature, great 18th century classic. I'm not going to quote the passage now. But there's a famous passage that's usually interpreted to mean that you can't derive a judgment of what ought to be the case from what is the case. What Hume says in this passage, again, I'm going to paraphrase it rather than quote it directly, is that he says that, well, he's been looking, examining various books, and sees all sorts of statements about what is the case. And then he says, well, then suddenly people start talking about what ought to be. And he says, how did you get from one to the other? So he said, well, most people say he's saying, well, you can't really do it. You can't really get an ought from it. Some people don't agree with that. And I see a question from Jay. People use value judgment to make economic decisions. How is that built into the descriptive model? Yes, I'm going to be, that's an excellent question, Jay. You have very good questions. I'm going to be addressing that exact question in a few slides from now. So I'm not forgetting your question. I'm just going to be getting to that. Okay, so according to Hume, at least one way of taking Hume, Hume says, well, if you have descriptive statements, say, well, what is the case? Say, we have all these statements, say, about how an economy works, prices determined by supply and demand. Nothing follows, according to Hume, this is sometimes called Hume's law, about what ought to be the case. So according to this view, called generally called Hume's law, from a statement about the way the world is, nothing logically follows about what ought to be the case. So I want to point out, just as I said, economics isn't committed to the view that all value judgments are subjective, meaning by that that value judgments are just expressions of opinion. Economics is also not committed to this position, namely that Hume's law is true. A lot of economists, again, including Mises, did believe Hume's law is true, that you can't derive statements from what ought to be from state, just from statements about what is the case at Hume's law. So economics is not committed to this position. You can see why, well, that's a particular position about ethics. And this is, economics isn't committed to any particular ethical theory or view about the nature of ethics. So you can think, as some people do, that Hume's law is false. But the example, say, somebody who thought, well, Rand would be one who thought Hume's law is false because she thought just what ought means, something, say, something ought to be the case, means it's doing what's required for your own survival. So if she thought states of what ought to be the case do follow from certain facts, so she wouldn't accept Hume's law. But economics, as I say, isn't committed to either position. You can either accept to reject Hume's law or not. Maybe you haven't made up your mind about it, and still this is not part of economics. You're not committed to any particular view about whether Hume's law is true or false, just as you're not committed to a particular view about whether ethical judgments are just subjective preferences or whether they're true or false. Now, one point I think is very important, just this is not strictly part, this isn't part of economics, I just want to mention because it's important point in ethics, I think many people miss. Many people think, well, okay, they accept Hume's law, they say you can't derive an ought from an is just from a statement about how the world what the world is like. Nothing follows about what ought to be the case. They say Hume's law is true. Then they say, well, they think this rules out an objective ethics. They say that, well, if you can't derive statements, judging not what ought to be the case from what the description of the world, then all you're left with is subjective preferences. But that doesn't follow. Somebody could say, well, there are objectively true statements about what ought to be the case. They're not just matters of opinion, but they don't follow from facts about the world. They just say certain ethical principles that are self-evidently true. So, as I say, it's wrong to torture babies for fun. Somebody could say, well, that doesn't follow from particular facts about the world. It's just something we grasp to be true, and it isn't just a matter of opinion. I'm not saying that view is true, although as it happened, I think it is true. But if you hold that, you'd be holding, there can be objectively true statements, judgments of ethics, but they aren't just subjective opinions, but then you wouldn't be saying that those have been derived from descriptions of the world. So you could say, well, Hume's law is true, but it still doesn't rule out objective ethics. I see there's, let me just have a quick look. There's a question Michael asks me. Now, the question was, answer to it's a bit off the subject, that Sartre said the truth is not possible only to a matter of degree, and Rand would say that this view is divorcing knowledge from its percepts. Well, I'm sure she would say that, but I mean, somebody could hold, I think, consistently that whatever you claim to know derives from all your concepts derived from perception, but still hold that truth is possible only to a matter of degree. So I don't think that Rand's view how concepts are derived will directly invalidate what your professor is saying. But I don't want to go into that too much because that's a little off the subject. Now, when and now raise an objection to what I've been saying. As you know from my previous lectures, I like objections a lot, as long as I have answers to them, at least as long as I think I have answers to them, which is not the same thing. Now, suppose Hume's law is false. I don't say it is false, I doubt it, but let's just assume it's false. But Hume's law says we can't derive a judgment about what ought to be the case just from judgments or propositions about what is the case. Suppose Hume's law is false, that says it is possible, but nothing rules out deriving what ought to be the case from what is the case. So if Hume's law is false, isn't it possible then that some descriptive statements of economics do imply judgments about what ought to be the case? You see how what this objection is saying, well, look, we have certain descriptive statements about how the economy works. Now, what if these statements imply some judgments about what ought to be the case? Well, you can't say that's not possible because Hume's law says you can't do that, because we're assuming Hume's law is false. So maybe you can do that. Maybe you can get from statements about descriptions of the economy to judgments about what ought to be the case. So if you can do that, how could we say that economics is a purely descriptive science? You know, just before I answer that, I just want to mention a point about terms. Now, in some contexts, it's important to distinguish about judging about what ought to be the case, you say what people should do, like you should enroll in my next course, I'll get my money. That's a statement of what ought to be the case. So statements, you say there's something more serious against, say someone's morally obligated to respect other people's rights, saying what ought to be the case. And sometimes we distinguish between that and judgments about what's good and bad. Say it's good that people get their preferences realized, other things being equal. It's bad that they're suffering more. So see, we'd be distinguishing judgment about what ought to be the case and just judgments about what's good and bad. Of course, there's all sorts of views in how those two ideas are related, how we relate judgments about what ought to be the case, judgment about what's good and bad. But here, I'm not interested in distinguishing between judgment about what ought to be the case and judgment about what's good and bad. I'm lumping them all together and calling both value judgments. So when I'm talking about value judgments or values, can be refer either to judgment about what ought to be the case, what ought not to be the case, and judgments about what's good and bad. So now to return to the question I was raising is, I mean, the objection is somebody says, well, okay, suppose Hume's law is false, supposing you can, in certain cases, derive an ought from an is, well, then what if you get some of the descriptive statements in economics imply certain value judgments, say it's not what ought to be the case, then how can you say that they're not part of economics? Now, how would we answer that objection? Well, one thing to say is, even if some factual judgments do imply ought judgments, many at least of the propositions of economics don't, or at least they don't appear to. Suppose we say price is determined by supply and demand. It doesn't appear to generate any judgments about what we ought to do. It just seems like a basic statement of how price is determined. It doesn't imply any judgment about what ought to be the case. So we could say, well, at least even if it's possible that statements of descriptive statements saying about what is the case do imply statements about what ought to be the case. I'm not saying they do, I'm just saying let's assume Hume's law is false. It would still be the case that large parts of economics are purely descriptive. We could then raise a new objection. Aren't there some statements of economics that do imply judgment about what ought to be done? So I would say, well, large parts of economics appear to be purely descriptive, but aren't there some that don't, aren't purely descriptive? Suppose we say, when we said this in one of the previous lectures, minimum wage laws cause unemployment. Remember why that works, because then if you have a worker who isn't, whose productivity is below the minimum wage, and the employer will have no incentive to hire him or her, so he or she will be unemployed. So suppose you say minimum wage laws cause unemployment, doesn't this give us a reason to oppose minimum wage law? I might have some arguments on the other side, but isn't this at least one reason you'd have to consider to be opposed to minimum wage laws? They cause unemployment. So it appears then, suppose somebody said, well, look, here's a factual statement, minimum wage laws cause unemployment. This isn't dependent on value judgment, it's just a matter of fact, minimum wage laws cause unemployment. But doesn't this imply that, well, we have a reason to be against minimum wage law? So how can we say, if that's right, we have reasons to oppose minimum wage laws that derive just from economic theory, how can we say economics is a purely descriptive science? So we could respond to this objection. Remember, the objection is, well, we've said minimum wage laws cause unemployment, so that appears to imply that we have a reason to oppose minimum wage laws, not necessarily a conclusive reason, at least we have a reason against minimum wage laws. So then it appears that economics does imply some value judgment, therefore economics can't be a purely descriptive science. So one way we could answer this is to say, in order to have a reason to oppose minimum wage laws, we have to accept the premise unemployment is bad. And this doesn't follow from the premise minimum wage laws cause unemployment. I suppose you like people being unemployed. You're kind of a misanthrope. You just like people not having an income. Or maybe you think people are working too much, so you just like the idea that people are unemployed. Then you wouldn't have a reason to think minimum wage laws cause unemployment. So this response would say, no, you're not able to derive conclusions about what we ought to do or what's good or bad just from the descriptive statement, because we have to add an additional value premise. We can't just say, well, the minimum wage laws cause unemployment, therefore we have a reason to oppose minimum wage laws. We need the additional premise, minimum wage laws, unemployment is bad. So this isn't something we can get from economics. I think there's a great deal in that response, but if we take it, we're accepting Hume's law. We're saying, look, the judgment, the minimum wage laws cause unemployment, doesn't by itself imply that there's a reason to oppose minimum wage laws. We need this extra premise, value premise, unemployment is bad. So if you take this line, you're accepting Hume's law. Remember, Hume's law says you can't derive things about what ought to be the case or what's good or bad just from the description of the world. So if you accept this objection, this way responds to this that I've given, then you're accepting Hume's law. But what happens if we don't accept Hume's law? Let us say, well, we don't think you need this additional premise to get to the view that we have a reason to oppose minimum wage laws. As you say, it directly follows from the premise that minimum wage laws cause unemployment, we have a reason to oppose minimum wage laws. Now, you could say, look, if you say that, you're just wrong. But I'm saying, what if you do say it? What if some people might think Hume's law is false? So what happens then? So one response, we could then say, well, we could admit that certain economic judgments may imply judgments about what we should be done. So we can say, well, maybe this is a case where an economic a statement about how the economy works that we suggest a reason about what should be done if minimum wage laws do cause unemployment. Maybe that does imply a judgment about what should be done, at least other things being equal. So we could say we do get this implication. However, economics doesn't make such judgments as part of other disciplines. Remember, all this is true only if we reject Hume's law. If we accept Hume's law, then we get right away that they're not part of economics. But from the description of the world, we don't get any statements about what ought to be the case. So here we're saying, even if you think there are value judgments that objective value judgments that follow from the description of the world, they're not part of economics. So we say, well, they're separate disciplines. Just because they follow from economic propositions doesn't make them part of economics. I think this is very much a response to what Jay was saying. People have certain value, might have certain value judgments in applying economic policies, but those aren't part of economic science as such. you could say, if there are objectively true statements that follow from economics, well, they're still in a separate category. Now, I see a question here. Jay says, I pay my wage above market equilibrium. Is that irrational for descriptive economics? Is that a value judgment? If so, then I violated descriptive economics. Well, it isn't irrational, no, because remember the way Mises uses rationality, which is any use of means to achieve ends is counts as rational. And you're not violating descriptive economics. You're not, because economics is saying it isn't the case that anybody would have reason, will ever pay wage above the equilibrium price. It would just be suggesting that if people who do that would then have sort of a non, would have giving people this higher wage would become considered a consumption good on their part. So you wouldn't be violating descriptive economics if people did that. Suppose you say something like, people who pay for this course have to pay $95, I think it is, to get this course. But those I especially like somebody, so I said, well, I'm going to try to arrange it so this person doesn't get charged anything. That wouldn't violate descriptive economics. It would just be that I wanted to give that person something. So, as I say, this response would be saying, well, certain economic judgment not description, do imply objectively true value judgments, but they're part of other disciplines. Still, economics is a separate area. So one needs to realize, if you think that value judgments are subjective, you think there aren't objectively true value judgments, then you'll think it's more important to keep value judgments out of economics. If you say, well, there are objectively true value judgments, you say, well, we want the separate discipline, economics, and we keep our ethical judgments, even though they're objective, a separate science. You can certainly do that, but it isn't so as important as if you think to keep them separate, if you think, well, they're just subjective, so this would really ruin the science claim to be objectively true if you put them in the science. So people who think that value judgments are subjective have more of an incentive to keep the judgments separate. So as I was saying, let's just go over it. Economics is a value-free science, and this is true whether you accept Hume's law or reject it. So if you say, if you say descriptive statements don't imply any value judgments, then you can see, well, economics is value-free. But even that you're accepting Hume's law, but even if you reject Hume's law, you can still say it's a value-free science, because you say then, well, if there are implications of certain propositions in economics that have to do with how the world ought to be and what's good and bad, they're just not part of economics. Now, again, following my usual pattern of raising objections, some people might say, well, is it possible to achieve such a value-free science? So one view is, well, don't some economic laws concern values? For example, suppose I say, which is one of the propositions that Mises places great stress on, other Austrian economists, a person will always choose his most highly valued alternative. So you have various actions available to you, so you're going to choose the one that ranks highest on your preference scale. So suppose you say that, well, a person will always choose his most highly valued alternative. So, well, isn't that a value proposition? It's a proposition saying that choosing the most highly valued alternative So how can you say economics is value free if you're making that statement and other statements like that? Now, you note that this objection, and the objection is, how can, you can't say economics is a value free science because some of the propositions of economics, important propositions of economics, concern values. So that's the objection. Now, remember, this objection does not assume that Hume's law is false. This has nothing to do with that view of Hume's law, because Hume's law is that if you start with purely descriptive statements, you won't be able to deduce any statements about values. But this objection is saying you're starting with certain statements that appear to be value generating. You say these are part of economics, but you can't say economics is a value-free science because it has these propositions about value in them. But this objection isn't any good because these statements, say, one I just gave and others like it, I say, the person always chooses the most highly valued alternative. That isn't a value judgment. It's a factual statement about value judgment. That when I say you'll always choose your highest ranking alternative, I'm not making a value judgment myself. I'm just making a descriptive statement about someone else's value judgment, or even about my own value judgment. But that isn't a value judgment. I'm not saying it's good or bad that people always choose their most highly ranked alternative. I'm saying that is the case. It's not a value judgment. It's a descriptive statement. I'll tell you one story in it. I think it's funny, but it actually happened. Several years ago, at the Austrian Scholars Conference, my great friend Roberto Madunio, who teaches at the University of Rome, was giving a paper, and she asked me to help her on the question and answer part after a paper because she wasn't sure she would understand everybody's English. Of course, I don't understand the English either, but she wanted me to help her out. So someone asked the question, isn't the view that all ethical judgments are relative self-refuting, because then that person is saying all ethical judgments are relative, but that's an ethical judgment, so that's relative too, but he's claiming that this judgment is true, so isn't that self-refuting? So I said, I made just this kind of description I'm making now, I said, well, no, that isn't self-refuting because he's not claiming that. He's making an ethical judgment that's relative. He's making a statement about ethical judgment. He's saying they're all relative, but his state, he could consistently say, it's absolutely true that all ethical judgments are relative. So when I said this, people thought I was joking. They started laughing. I got a much better response for that to that one than I do for almost all my jokes, and it wasn't a joke. So the joke was on me there. But that actually happened. So there is an important distinction to bear in mind, that statements about value judgments are not themselves value judgments. They're descriptive. So this objection is that, well, economics has certain statements about values doesn't imply that it's not a descriptive statement. Now, Jay says it can still be incorrect. That's perfectly true. I mean, a statement about values can be correct. It's just that particular one wouldn't about I'm not sure which one you have in the view, but you mean the one on relative, ethical relatives, or the one I gave about you always choosing the most highly valued preference. You're quite right. Factual statements can be true or false, so you could certainly raise objections, just that it wouldn't be self-refuting to say that all ethical judgments are relative, because that wouldn't be an ethical judgment itself. Now, even though I've been arguing so far, economics is a value-free science, almost everybody cares about particular economic policies. People want to say, we're having sale now in America, also through these disputes, the president wants to put in certain stimulus package and increase taxes on the very well off, so people have all differences of opinion about it. People care about particular economic policy. It's not something like, well, we're studying physics and say we have particular views on what the elementary particles are, and what people don't really have strong preferences about, we can't really do much with that. I mean, people don't have strong preferences with such and such are the elementary particles. Once we have the results, everybody accepts those. But in economics, people care about policies a great deal. And here, how we have views about economic policies if economics is a value-free science. Well, here what we do, what we have, each of us has ethical views. We have opinions on what's right or wrong. And we can use these opinions, these views that we have, or theories that we have, to help decide about what economic policies to support. So one thing, it's very important, one thing Murray Rothbard emphasized a great deal in his writing, it's very important when we're doing this, when we're trying to prescribe policy in economics, trying to say what good or bad policy, we should be aware of what ethical views we hold. Rothbard is of the opinion, I'll be discussing this very shortly later, that a lot of economists make policy judgments, these policy judgments rest on certain ethical assumptions, but they're not, the economists aren't really aware that they're making particular ethical assumptions. He thought they were confused, they're just making certain claims, and these rest on particular controversial ethical assumptions, they're not aware of these. So one thing when I say that, it's important to be aware of what ethical views we hold. This isn't itself a proposition of economics, so we should be aware of the ethical views we hold. If you're not, that doesn't violate any law of economics. So we're not violating the value neutrality of economics if we say it's important to be aware of what ethical views we hold. That doesn't violate value neutrality because it doesn't claim to be a judgment of ethics. As I said just a minute ago, Murray Rothbard pointed out that many economists take for granted controversial value judgments. They just don't realize when they make these certain policy prescriptions, they're assuming certain value judgments that could be rationally denied or even more that are very questionable. An example, remember I gave a talk on, one of the initial lectures on competition and monopoly. Now, very often neoclassical economists will take perfect competition to be the aim of antitrust policy, even though it's just an analytical model. You remember what perfect competition is? It's the view that you only have competition in the economy when there's a great many firms in a particular industry and none of them has any influence on price. Every firm is a price taker. There are other things in the model that you can just go back to the lecture and get those and find out what those are. But this is just a model that neoclassical economists assume. They say, well, this is what we mean by perfect competition. But they take for granted that that's the aim of antitrust policy, that what we, the policymakers should be doing, say we have very large firms like we have the Microsoft or General Motors, that we should really break those up ideally because we're not having perfect competition if we have large firms that can influence price. So here we have to be careful about the word perfect. It's just the name for something. It doesn't, just calling something perfect doesn't imply that this is an ideal that we should be trying to realize. But many economists, you know, classical economists, do take it to be an ideal. And they're, I don't think they should, but I think they're wrong in that. But the point here is not whether they're right or wrong, but it's just that they should be aware that that's what they're doing, that if they're not, they just say, well, here's a particular model, so then we should change the actual economy to accord with this model. And they don't, not really clear why we should do that. Now, there's a possible counter they could give, but I'm not going to go into that because I don't think the counter is right. And I think it would be kind of a bit of a digression to go into how certain neoclassical economists would answer that. It has to do with something about efficiency. But that's a more advanced topic. What they mean by this, I'm not going to go into that. But basically, the basic objection is they're just assuming that perfect competition is the model, and we shouldn't take just because the ideal, just because you've constructed a certain model, it doesn't need to have some reason for saying that reality should be reconstructed in accord with that model. Just coming up with a particular model doesn't do that. So that these economists are relying on an implicit judgment. There's something really good about perfect competition as opposed to imperfect competition. Well, you think, well, isn't perfect better than imperfect? But remember, those are just names we're giving these particular models. We could call it the one imperfect, where all the firms are price takers. And then that wouldn't be a reason to say, no, we should, if we're in that sort of situation, we should try to change that to a perfect model, which would now be ones where you have large firms, the larger firms. Just calling something perfect doesn't make it an ethical ideal. Now, another example, and I think this is the one Jay asked in the earlier lecture, has to do with what's called the efficiency equity trade-off. Arthur Oaken, who was an economist, I think was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, I think quite a long time ago, I think possibly in the 1960s. So he was the one who popularized this phrase, the efficiency equity trade-off. Now, what does equity mean when we talk about efficiency equity trade-off? What it means is a movement toward equality. So suppose you have a situation, this is the case nowadays, when there are certain corporate CEOs who earn several hundred times as much as ordinary workers. So a situation like that is said to violate equity, according to this view, because there is such vast inequalities of pay between the CEO and the ordinary worker. But here, again, there's a concealed ethical judgment that equality is desirable. Now, I'm not now arguing that it isn't, although I don't see any reason why it is desirable. My opinions on ethics aren't the topic now. It's just that what I want to illustrate is that this talking about efficiency equity trade-off is presupposing the ethical judgment that equality is desirable. And if you do that, you should be aware that you're making such an ethical judgment. Where the trade-off would come in would be people would say, well, it would be ethically desirable that, say, the CEO and the ordinary worker earned the same thing, or at least closer to the same thing than they do now. But if we try to compress the salaries too much, that would interfere with the productivity, or we wouldn't be able to put out as much, and then everybody would get less, so we have kind of a trade-off between efficiency and equality. So all I want you to get from this is not the view that equality is a good idea, although I don't think it is myself, but it just, you should be aware if you talk in such language that you're making a particular ethical judgment. Now, another example is sometimes there are complaints that wages and prices are sticky. People say, well, we can't rely on the market to adjust by itself. If there's unemployment, we can't just rely on wages to go down just by so that people be unemployed, because it takes too long, the wages are too sticky. And here the assumption is that it's the rate at which the free market will change price and wages has something wrong with it. And you could hold that view if you want, but you should be clear on why exactly you think it's wrong with it. Just talking about price stickiness suggests there's something wrong with the way the market is doing things. It's not clear what it is. Again, if you hold certain ethical views, you should be explicit about what those are and not just sort of sneak them in through certain terminology. Now, I want to now raise an objection to something we've been saying in several lectures. Of course, remember, in a number of lectures I discussed the broken window fallacy. For example, I mentioned in one lecture that defenders of government spending to stimulate the economy ignore the fact that money taken in taxes would also be spent. So I'm saying, well, these people are saying we've got to stimulate the economy by spending on all these nice government projects, but they're forgetting that there's money that people would be spending otherwise. So the question is here, if I'm saying this, I'm saying, well, they're forgetting that money would be spent otherwise, aren't we making the value judgment we should take account of these constants? We shouldn't just say government is spending on this and not consider that people would be spending money otherwise. So aren't we making a value judgment in policy we should take account of all these consequences? Isn't that a value judgment? If that economic is a value free science, then aren't I violating value neutrality? I talked about the broken window fallacy. Now, Mises had a very interesting answer to this. And he said that economists who stress the long-run consequence of policy, also say in this case broken window, were stressing what would have happened had the government not stimulated the economy. He said that economists who do this are not assuming that the long run is more important than the short run, or that they're not assuming that the money that people have been spending by themselves is more significant than what the government is spending the money on. They're not making this value judgment. All that economists are saying is that we should be aware of all the consequences of the proposed policy. So we're not saying it would be value judgment if she said because the government, when it takes money from people in taxes and spends it, is also taking away money that people would have spent otherwise. If you said because of that they shouldn't do it, that is a value judgment. If you just say, well, this is a consequence of what the government is spending that people will have less to spend by themselves, that isn't a value judgment. It's just all that Mises would be saying is you should be aware of all these different consequences of policy. Now, we should then, though, raise the objection further and say, is this a value judgment? Namely, that you should be aware of all the consequences of policy you're considering, all the relevant consequences. appear to be just a precept of rational action, you should be aware of all the consequences of what you're doing, rather than just a controversial value judgment. It just appears to be a sort of a part of rationality to take account of the relevant consequences of what you're doing. And this raises the issue, which is, again, a topic for another course, maybe this next course in libertarian ethics. Are there other such precepts of rational action, they don't even take account of all the consequences of what you're doing? There are some people, especially those in the Kantian tradition, say you can get a whole ethics out just from considering the nature of rationality. Hans Hoppe is one who could be interpreted as holding that view. So somebody might say, well, you can get sort of ethical, you can have judgments that are relevant to ethics but don't involve appeal to value judgments, they're just precepts of rationality. Now, Mises, again, in what I'm going to end up with, just a few things about Mises, which I think are extremely interesting. Mises is very firm on the proposition that economics is value free, so economics is value free science, but he doesn't accept that from this value freedom, that he doesn't accept that economists, as an economist, he thinks can still criticize policy, particularly policy proposals. So economics is value free. Now you think, say if you're going to say something like minimum wage laws are bad, well, then you'd have to bring in certain value judgments that you might hold. So to be violating, if you said minimum wage laws are bad, you couldn't make that as value-free proposition. But Mises said, well, an economist, just while he's remaining within economics, can still criticize policy proposals by asking, can these proposals achieve the ends of their own advocates? And as an example, it would be agreed. Does this serve as criticism of price control? Some people say we should have a maximum price for milk because poor people can't afford milk at, say, this very high price that it now is. So if we have a lower price for milk, say, milk can't rise above a certain price, then the poor will be able to buy. To buy milk, I should say, but I don't know why I said that in this another typo. But Mises says, well, if you have price control, it's going to reduce the amount of milk for sale because at the price control that's below the market price, some of the milk producers won't find it profitable to produce milk and they'll leave the market, so there'll be less milk available. But this isn't what the people favored price control wanted. So price control won't achieve the aim of those who support it. So this isn't a value judgment. Price control is a bad idea, but it's a factual claim that certain means, namely price control, will not achieve a certain end, making the good available to those who want it at affordable prices. So what Mises is saying is economists can say this particular policy won't achieve the goals of those who favor it. So that isn't a value judgment, but it's certainly relevant to policy because saying if you want milk or other goods available to the poor, price control isn't a way of doing that. And that's just a factual statement about whether a means is suitable to achieve a given end. Now, suppose we accept this, it turns out, though, that the results of economics strongly suggest certain value judgments. Say, once we know that price control won't achieve what its advocates want, It's hard to avoid the value judgment. Price control is a bad idea. So remember what we're saying so far. We're not violating value freedom because we say price control won't achieve what its advocates want. But once we know that, isn't it pretty easy to get to the value judgment price control is a bad idea? Now, someone who is determined to avoid value judgment might again say, well, it's just a principle of rationality or adopted the means to achieve your ends. So if you say price control is a bad idea, this person might say, well, then you're not really making value judgments, you're just appealing to a principle of rationality. Let's look at a clearer case where it appears that you can get to a value judgment from economic analysis. Now, your famous argument, I didn't discuss in this class, but you're probably familiar with if you studied Austrian economics at all, that Mises shows that in a developed modern economy, socialism leads to calculational chaos. That a socialist, essentially planned socialist economy couldn't decide to have an efficient use of resources. So if this is right, and I think Mises makes an extremely strong case for his argument, supporters of socialism then have a choice. They either have to give up socialism and accept chaos, because remember, Mises is saying socialism leads to calculational chaos. So if he's right, then socialists have to either accept chaos or give up socialism. Now, it's difficult to imagine that people would accept chaos, so we seem driven to the value judgment socialism is a bad thing. So if from economics where it doesn't strictly imply perhaps value judgment, we seem kind of pushed in a direction of at least some value judgment. Now, Mises developed, and this will be, I think this is the last thing I'll say, Mises developed an important theory of ethics that made use of examples like the one on price control and socialist calculation I just gave. He thought that all value judgments are subjective. Remember what that means is they're just expressions of personal preference. There aren't true or false statements about ethics. They're not objective in the same way. So a statement that price is determined by supply and demand is objective. It isn't dependent on whether you approve of that or disapprove, it just is the case that Mises thought value judgments are subjective. But Mises thought that even though value judgments are subjective, it turns out almost all people want peace and prosperity. And given this fact, we can say they should favor the free market. So the should here tells them how to achieve the goals they have. So Mises then thought, well, he can maintain ethical subjection. He didn't hold that value judgments is subjective, but he could still say that people should favor the free market in a stronger sense than saying he likes the free market person, saying this is how you can achieve the goals you want. So I think now, I think that's it for the lecture. So the rest of the time, I'll just put on this Q&A. So if you have questions, please type them into the Q&A box if this works. Now I see some Martin is having a problem seeing my head. Well, you're better off not seeing it. He says, okay, so do we have some questions, comments, objections? Justin says, so according to Rothbard, Friedman's withholding tax necessarily had value judgments underlying it. Well, it isn't the withholding tax itself would have value judgments underlying it, but suppose, say, as I think Friedman did, suppose he said, well, this will make, if we have a withholding tax, it'll make it easier to collect taxes, and we need to do this because the government needs to have money in order to win World War II. Those would be making judgment that the good thing that the government kept money so it can win World War II. So I think that would be where the value judgments come in, not in the policy, but in the reasons you have for advocating the policy. Okay. Let's see. Well, anyone other than Justin have a question? Leslie said, how did Rothbard differ from Mises on ethics? Well, I suppose if I wanted to make money, I should say, you should enroll in this next class one that Danny and I are giving on libertarian ethics, and you'll find out. But basically, the answer is, Rothbard did not agree with Mises that all value judgments are subjective. He thought there was an objective ethic based on natural law, and he thought what would be from natural law we could get what is human nature would dictate certain judgments about what kind of political ethics we should have, namely one that each person should be considered a self-owner, each person should have disposition over his own body. Many held that we have rights to acquire property in the state of nature. So Rothbard thought Mises was wrong to say that value judgments were subjective. He thought they were not objective ethics. And this is one of the principal topics that Danny and I will be addressing in this next course. Christopher said, so if all value judgments are subjective and there are no objective ethics, why should we listen to Mises? In other words, isn't that one of those self-refuting things? Why isn't that relativistic? Well, Christopher, this was a question I tried to answer in the lecture. It's an extremely good question you're asking, but let's go over it again. Suppose we say all value judgments are subjective. That isn't a value judgment. That's a factual judgment about value judgment. Suppose I say all people in this class are under 85 years old. That's a factual statement. Suppose I say all people in this class value peace and prosperity. That's also a factual statement. It's about value judgment. It's also factual. So it's not a self-refuting statement. So it's not relativistic. It's absolutely true, according to Mises. I don't think he's right about this, but if he is, he's making things absolutely true, all value judgments are subjective. And the question, why should we listen to Mises, and why do you think we should listen to him? Well, he would say, because if you do this listening to him will help you achieve what you want to do, what you want, maybe you want peace and prosperity, so you should listen to him. And that, if he's right about that, that's something that's objectively true. It's not just his opinion. Now, Jay asked, how do Austrians respond to every economic choice has moral implications? In other words, if I build a road, then I can't feed the hungry. Well, it strikes me that it's probably true that when I'm choosing, my choice always has certain moral implications, but that is perfectly consistent with Austrian economics, because Austrian economics is just analyzing what's involved in choice. It isn't making judgments about the particular goals people have or particular moral views people have. So it could well be the case, and probably is, that economic choice has moral implications, but those moral implications, judging what's right or wrong, isn't part of economics. Now, Justin said, early in the lecture, someone mentioned that Rand thought that ethics was about human survival. But even if you accept this, why would you have to desire human survival? Well, I don't think Rand thought that you did. She thought that people who didn't wouldn't be able to desire and value anything else, but she did view that as a fundamental choice. And she wouldn't view that as an objection to her view, because she's not really basing ethics on desire. So even if somebody said, well, I don't want to survive, she'd say, well, that just shows there's something wrong with this person. She wouldn't regard that as too much of an objection to what her view. So she isn't somebody, she's thinking people would be irrational if they said, okay, this is what I need to survive, so what? But if they did say that, she'd say, well, then they just, in her view, they just couldn't choose anything else. Now, do you think Alan Greenspan's comment on burning homes to fix marketing's broken window fallacy will be your solution? Well, I'm not sure what he said. Did he say that burning homes is going to generate spending to stimulate the economy? If he said that would be the broken window fallacy. My solution, if you mean to the current crisis, would be just to let the free market operate without government interference. I think the market is perfectly capable of necessary adjustments by itself, and government interference will make things harder. So I think he did commit the broken window fallacy. That's what he said. Let him burn his own house down. Fine with me. Now, I should say, you know, Alan Greenspan was at one time a member of the Ayn Rand Circle, and George Reisman, who's some of you know, he's lectured with Mises, was also in the circle, and George had a very strong dislike for Alan Greenspan. He couldn't stand him. And Murray Rothbard was also knew Greenspan's like, he didn't like him either. If you just type in and you Google Murray Rothbard, Alan Greenspan, you'll find a very good article that Murray wrote around 1987. Is reprinted on the Mises side. highly recommend that if you're interested in Greenspan. Some of Michael said that Greenspan turned to the dark side. Yes, I think that would be one thing both Reisman and Rothbard would say. The government buying book would have been a low cost option. Well, I think an even lower cost option would be to let the market operate without government interference. Okay, well, we have about 9 minutes left. Anybody else have anything? Everybody understands ethics. Just oh wait, let me see. Here's one. Jesse says, "Are you familiar with Leading Light Communist Organization?" And a lecture, I heard a lecture of someone associated with them on YouTube where he defended Stalin's genocide. No, I don't know that one. There are people who do that. It seems very strange that somebody would take that view, but I mean, after all, Stalin did such a thing, and there were people who supported Stalin. Hitler, it seems very sad, but it was the case. But I don't know this Leading Light Communist Organization. You think they wouldn't dare to say such a thing? What was his defense of Stalin's genocide? That it was needed to build communist society, or what? Now, Christopher said, so I went back in the chapters of your book and had more questions. Could I email them to you later, especially this chapter on supply and demand? Oh, yes, certainly. I'll be happy to try to answer them if I can. It's been a long time since I wrote that book, but I'll certainly try to answer them, assuming I can understand what I said. What can you say about your next course? Well, Martin, I'll be giving two courses. One I'm giving with Danny is on libertarian ethics, where we're considering three libertarian ethical theorists, Mises, Rothbard, and Hans Hoppe, and we're going to discuss their different ethical theories. And I'll be giving lectures on Rothbard and Hoppe. And Danny will be talking about Mises. We're each giving three lectures. I think this would be a very good course because Danny is a great expert on Mises, and most people don't support Mises' views of ethics. He's very much liked as an economist, but his ethical views haven't gotten that big of a following, and I think Danny makes a strong case for this, and I'll be trying to, of course, knock him down. He'll be doing the same with me. but so we should enjoy the battle. Now, the other course I'm going to be giving, just doing by myself, is called The Real Causes of America's Wars. I'm going to be discussing different wars that the U.S. has been in, like the war between the states, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, onset of the Cold War, and in the Korean War in Vietnam, and I'll be giving an analysis of what the different historians have said about those, especially the revisionist historians who question the justification. The state always said, well, we have to get into this war because we have to fight the bad guy. So I'll be discussing some of the I think it's wrong with such a view. And Christopher says, what should I tell the email so they give it a priority? Well, just put questions about economic reasoning. I think might be a good thing. But I read all my emails. So if you send me questions, I'll definitely try to answer them. Justin says, one point was there were tens of thousands of Russian soldiers affected Germany who should have been killed, meaning okay, might have been all the killings before then, the number of defections would have been even higher. Well, you know, they actually sent some of the prisoners back to were Allied prisoners sent them back to Russia. I mean, it isn't clear. I mean, why should you hold that people who are just revolting against Stalinist tyranny should be killed? Sounds like this person is has a warped sense of value. Martin says, need of course converting the rabble to the Austrian school. Well, that's an interesting idea. I don't know if I'm qualified as a rabble derouser. But it's an interesting idea that you have. So you don't agree with shoes on something. No, that would be putting it mildly. And you know what? Stalin got his start as in revolutionary study as a bank robber, you know. And he's one, of course, one of the great mass murderers of all time. And somebody says here, Rebecca's going to sign up for Real Cause of America's War. Well, good for you, Rebecca. I hope there are many more like you. They say this means more money for me. Christopher says, what are your thoughts on socialism requiring the free market to perpetuate, at which point it removes it? Relies on freedom of speech to develop, at which point it says removing the freedom of speech. Well, that's a very interesting question. It would certainly be the case that socialism requires a free market to exist, because otherwise it couldn't calculate, just like the Soviet economy had to rely on the capitalist economy to get their prices. If there had been world social movement, it would completely collapse. It relies on freedom of speech. Well, that wouldn't be absolutely true, because we could imagine a socialist movement saying in this society, it didn't allow free speech, it just operated by revolutionary means. so it wouldn't have to rely on free speech, but of course it very often does, and then once it gets in, just as you said, it then that we don't have freedom of speech anymore. There was one communist, famous American communist, Herbert Aptheker, who said, well, we do believe if you say that the communists don't believe in free speech itself, these are what we believe while we're in a non-communist time, we're going to use the principles that you favor, namely you believe in free speech, so you shouldn't suppress us, but this doesn't stop us from suppressing non-communist opinion once we get into it. It's pretty open about that. Well, is there a last question? So I think we're about out of time, but anybody has a last question or comment or anything? Well, okay, well, thanks very much. I want to thank everybody for coming to my course. I've been a very fine group of students, and I appreciate your coming to the course and your excellent questions, and I hope to see you in my next courses. Thanks very much. Thank you, everybody.